Liz Grossman.
I'm Rachel Gilman Rischel.
And I'm Molly Each. You're listening to the Between Bites podcast, a nonprofit food-inspired storytelling series. We feature first-person stories from chefs, restaurateurs, writers, and others in the food and drink industry. Episodes are recorded live in Chicago bars and restaurants. We hope you enjoy.
All right. So our next reader grew up in restaurants, working at his parents' diner on 35th and Western as early as age 9. After attending Washburn Trade School, one visit down in New Orleans was enough to make him fall in love with the cuisine, and he quickly soaked up any Cajun and Creole culinary secrets he could from mentors like Paul Prudhomme, Frank Brixton, and Emeril Lagasse. From there, he brought the Big Easy to Chicago with Heaven on 7, where Latin, South American, Asian, and other influences meld with New Orleans classics. In 2009, he opened the Purple Pig, passing the reins onto his son, partner Jimmy Banos Jr., to create the menu of Italian, Greek, and Spanish-influenced small plates. He's the author of 2 cookbooks and has made regular appearances on the Today Show, but says his greatest accomplishments so far have really been his children and 2 little grandchildren. Please join me in welcoming Jimmy Banos.
So when I actually asked Liz if I could do this, I think maybe 3 times ago or whatever, and she finally called me up and I said, I am a functional illiterate, okay? So, I said, okay, we'll do this. And then I called her, I think 2 weeks ago, I said, I'm panicking, okay? And I said, and then I was just kind of joking with her, of course, too. But so we talked about it, and we talked, my home is Chicago. I mean, I love this city. For good and for bad, it is truly the best city in the country. But then I have another love. I have New Orleans. It changed my whole entire life, Then I have a whole nother, New York. I go to vacation to New York to relax, and people look at me, are you out of your mind, And I said, my son worked there for 4 years, and my daughter went to school, and I'd sit out, we had a little place in the Village, and I, every morning, I'd smoke a cigar on the stoop and have a coffee, and I became part of the neighborhood. I really love New York, so I'm thinking, I have a lot of different homes, even though I have one, house in Chicago. But then my different travels, and when I was a 13-year-old, so I figured, let me talk about Greece. Not what you cook with, but I'm a Greek-American. Third-generation restaurateur, second-generation Greek-American. My mom and dad were both born here. My grandparents on both sides were in the restaurant business, so I didn't have a chance, But I love it. I love this business. And my mom and dad I was 13, and my dad's brother's son was 13, decided to send us to Greece, 2 13-year-old kids, which they should have been, if there was DCFS at that time, they should have been arrested. They put us on a plane. I mean, the flight attendant, they were stewardesses back then, would say, sorry about that, walk them to the gate. We just went to the gate and we flew to Montreal, and then there was some kind of creepy guy next to us also. I remember, you start thinking about this thing as I'm writing it down, and then go to Montreal, we go to Greece, go to Athens, and then my cousin, who just graduated college, he was a very adventurous gentleman. He was working in, I think he graduated about a year before that, but he was working in South America and took a freighter to Athens to meet us. So, who knows if he was even going to be able to make it, So we have 2 13-year-old kids, and then my grandfather's brother, who was probably 150 at the time, they met us at the airport. So then, are we going to stay in, I was aware, 13 years old, I was pretty with it at the time, I have to say, and so are we going to, sleep in Athens tonight? No, we're driving to the small, I'm a hillbilly Greek, we're in the mountains, so we go to this, we're driving through the mountain. This is not, now it's a straight shot, 2 hours right to the Village. It took 5 hours to drive. Now it was, 12 hours on the plane. Another 5, I was like, forget, it was ridiculous. And then I was aware of, the guy would shut the engine off when he's at the top of the mountain and what do you call it, put it in neutral. And I see, you know, I'm like, something's not right about this thing. So I said, what are all those little lights on the, like, crosses, like little visual, you know, things that are on the side of the road? They go, oh, well, and I didn't speak any Greek at the time. I still don't speak any Greek, but anyway. It was either baseball or Greek school, and I wanted to become a professional baseball player, but that sure didn't work out. I'm going to be like Billy Madison when my grandchildren go to Greek school. I'm going to be the big guy in the little small chair. I'm threatening to do that, and I'm going to do that, actually. But so anyway, they go, well, people drove off the road and, you know, died. So I'm like, oh, my God. So I was like, I looked at my cousin. I said, is this guy kidding me? We're going to, you know, don't worry. Okay, no problem. So we finally get to a small village. We get, you know, all dark. Then, you know, we get there, and the smell of, like, it was shit. So we go, and it was, they lived above the barn where the two or three donkeys were there. So now this is like my memories of Greece now. It's like, oh my God, we're starting out, you know, 13 hours with some creep on the plane. Then we take 5 hours, we almost die. So it's like, okay, we're starting off the trip really good. So then I had to go to the bathroom. Okay. We go through this little skinny little hallway off the kitchen, and I said, well, where's the bathroom? It's an odd house with all the chickens around it. I said, no, I can't. I'm not going to the washroom. I said, I can't do it. So go back in, probably starting to get toxic at that time. And the next day comes up. I get up in the morning. They had a really nice breakfast, and got to go to the bathroom. So we go back, and I sit down, and the chickens are pecking at my toes. I said, something's not right about this. But I figure, okay, we'll let it swing. You know, we'll see what happens. Still couldn't go because I just couldn't get, my joke, if anybody knows, I'm from the Twin Cities. And everybody will say, oh, you're from Minnesota? That's so nice. No, Berwyn and Cicero, okay? So there was no odd houses. We would pee in the alley if we'd have to go, or, you know, whatever it is. But so anyway, we would, my cousins, you know, are you okay? You know, you're turning, your color is not bright. I said, this is like, you know, three days now I've not gone, I can't. It's like, no. So this is a very good memory, you have to understand, because, you know, when you were talking about food, you'd say, what happens to the food? It goes, you know. So it's a good memory. So anyway, we go. I told you, Liz, it might be dangerous. So anyway, and great breakfast in the morning. There would be olive oil. They were rock farmers, so there was no olive trees where they lived. So anyway, they would fry eggs with totally drenched in olive oil, and I remember that. It was so good. And I think that olive oil finally got me. So then I had to go down this little skinny little hallway with friggin' 20 chickens, and I got released. I got free. It was a perfect thing. So that 4 days later, after I got there, my journey really started. So so we would go to. And you have to understand, this was in 71. So in the small village, and they call it Korio in Greek. I know a couple words. And this is outside Tripoli in the Peloponnese. It's in the heart of Greece. They didn't even know what Coca-Cola was. This is honest God truth. They were just starting to bring Coke in. So there was a Greek drink called Lemonada, which is a lemon drink, and Porta Galata, which is a orange drink. Tremendous. So we would have chicken. You know, friggin' chickens are all over the place. I can't even believe that I ate the damn chicken because I was going to the washroom with me at the same time. You know, so then they ended up killing it, and then we ended up eating it. You know, so my fears of going to the washroom with chickens in an odd house didn't bother me anymore. So then we go to my cousin's grandmother's house on his mom's side, and it was in Kalamata, which is a little bit more south, and they lived above a bakery. said, God, this is fantastic. We're smelling donkeys for 5 days, you know, it was a week, and now we're smelling beautifully baked bread. And then on the side of the road, when we're going there, on the side of the roads, there was these souvlaki or shish kebab stands where you just pull over on the side and just have these just amazing shish kebabs. So to me, that in that trip, we were there for, and then we'd have seafood. We'd go to Spartan. We have different seafood and things like that. So that stuck in my mind, going to the bathroom, not going to the bathroom. The Yiddo, because there was no, in 71, I don't think we had Yiddo. Or people call it gyro, but it's Yiddo. Okay. I don't think we had Yiddo in Chicago yet. It was close. It was really close. Parthenon was one of the first places that had it. So anyway, we, made our trip back and made it to Athens, came back home. Unbelievable trip. I started speaking English, Greek a little bit here or there. One of my first things, they asked me, are you sick? And I said, nah, yes. I didn't know they were telling me that. I was saying yes to everything. So next thing I know, there's like four-foot-nine ladies spitting at me and throwing water at me. And they gave me garlic to put in my pockets because they thought I was, somebody gave me the evil eye. So I told my cousin, we translated, I was fine. So 42 years later, which was 3 years ago, I was able to go back to Greece. I married an Italian girl, so she didn't want anything with Greece. We went just to Italy. So now she wants to go to Greece because everybody's going to Greece. It's unbelievable. So anyway, I got this Ted Diamantis from Diamond Importers, brings a lot of the Greek wine in the country, took us on this eating and basically drinking trip. And in my mind, I asked him before we went, I said, are we going to be able to go to my grandfather's village? Because I really want to see it. No, can't go. We got too many people, too much stuff to do. And we were all over Greece. So George Skouras, who's a big wine player in Greece, we were like, we met each other, we were instant like brothers from another mother. It was just awesome. Life-changing, actually. It was a life-changing trip for me. So we're in the vineyards up in the mountains, and we're looking at the vines and seeing what next year's crop is going to be. And I'm thinking to myself, this area is very familiar. We're talking 42 years before that. And I asked George, isn't my grandparents' village runner? No, it's 4 hours away. Okay, so we all get in the car. We're going to go out to eat. We're driving. We had two different cars. We're driving, and I see a U-shaped mountain with a village in it. And I said, George, this is my grandfather's village. And he looked at me and he goes, what did you say? I said, that's my grandfather's village. And he just kind of smiled. And I said, I'm thinking these guys, are bullshitting me the whole time and not giving me, said, oh, it's 4 hours away, 6 hours away. So we pull up, we go into the village, and we go into a little coffee shop. As you know, I don't know if you know that the Greeks invented coffee, okay? So I don't know if you know that. So we had coffee shops before Starbucks. So anyway, Mr. Montuano would disagree with me on that because he thinks Italy had coffee first, but that's not true. So anyway, we go to the little coffee shop, little 4'9". I can't believe that I became 6 foot tall because everybody in this village seemed like they were 4'9 or 5'1", So anyway, is there anybody? My name before my grandfather changed it was Banahutsis. So they go, is there any relative of Tasso Banahutsis? George, that was my grandfather's name was George, and his brother was Tasso, who still lived in the village. And she gets on the cell phone. It's priceless, Boom, gets on the cell phone. All of a sudden, here comes another 4'8" little lady comes down, She looked like she was 104 and smiling and just happy to see, somebody from civilization. And And she starts talking, and she goes, "My husband, her husband had a stroke. Her husband was related to my uncle's wife, so there was no Bannist blood in these people, but they were still, we would still call them family. So the husband was, I guess, bedridden in what do you call it, for like 2 years. But that a couple days before we got there, he said, they are coming. We're like, and we're all looking like, what the heck's going on? And they go, oh, they said that he saw a vision and saw that somebody was coming, some family member was coming. Now, she could have been lying to me. That's a good possibility, but I don't think so. It sounded really good. So we get to the house. I see no more donkeys. We walk up to the house. They kind of, it's actually looked really nice. And in my mind, I still had to see, I always remembered that skinny little gangway going to the chicken coop to go to the washroom. And now I wanted to go to the washroom. And it's like, I really want to see it. So they, you know, she saw that I was like really curious about the little hallway. And so she said in Greek, and of course, I had the interpreter, you know, Ted and George Skouras. They go, what are you looking down that hallway for? I said, well, I want to go to the bathroom. So I walked out there, and I see lemon trees now. It's like lemon trees and some other kind of fruit tree, and no chickens, no odd house. And so they said, they told her that, he's looking for the odd house and the chickens. So she proudly said, she goes, we don't have that anymore. We have indoor plumbing. So it was like, jeez, that's just fantastic, You got to understand, the small little village and indoor plumbing, it's just perfect. So to get back to the trip, then to get back to eating, we went to Nafplion. If you ever get a chance to go to Greece, you need to go there and have fish where you would just, the ocean was right there. The bay was right there. And the restaurant was here. And they said, we sat down for dinner, and they go, before you order, you have to come in the kitchen. We go in the kitchen, they open up all the refrigerators, and there was everything on ice, anything that you'd want. And we picked all these different things, and I said, and we sat down and ate, and to me it was just like, I'm at home. From when I was a kid, I remember that. And I remember the smells, I remember the village, and it all came together to me. So I feel very lucky that I could call many places my home. And a lot of people can't do that. I think most can. I think tonight, everybody who's talked so far can say that, which is really exciting. I feel very, very lucky. But we had some really awesome food and unbelievable wine. I don't want to start pitching the Greek wine, but it's fantastic. Hey, Tony, do you know that Greeks invented wine too? Okay. But anyway, that's it. Oh my God. I'll write you a check for this thing right now, because thank you very much. Liz, thank you.
Our next reader is the Deputy Food and Dining Editor at the Chicago Tribune. After spending 8 years on staff at various magazines and websites in New York, Chicago, and Washington, D.C., she's happily back in her favorite city. In her current role, she leads coverage of Chicago restaurants and bars, as well as report and write on national trends in food, wine, and spirits. In her career, she's covered everything from dining to pop culture to relationships for publications, including Glamour, Self, Conde Nast Traveler, Cosmopolitan, People, and Forbes.com. At People, she launched Great Ideas, a section featuring recipes, health, and fitness service pieces, and trend stories on chefs, restaurants, wine and spirits, and more. She's a Northwestern School of Journalism graduate with a passion for fitness, memorable meals, and a brand new puppy. Please welcome Marissa Conrad.
On Thanksgiving Day in 2001, I woke up a little before 7 a.m., and I got to work on my hair. Washed it with a nice shampoo, dried it painstakingly, blasting the heat at my roots for extra volume. Brushed on the Clinique eyeshadow. My mom had bought me it at the mall. I was 16, and I had somewhere special to go. My new friend Amanda had invited me to her house for her family's biggest event of the year. Thanksgiving breakfast. Now, for most people, breakfast on Thanksgiving Day is the lightest thing you can find in the house. A piece of toast, a yogurt. You know, after all, the turkey is coming. At Amanda's, apparently, Thanksgiving breakfast was a party with extended family and a buffet before they all went to her aunt's for dinner. The ultimate pregame. You have to dress up, Amanda had warned me. So I put on a nice sweater and my favorite fall skirt, the brown suede one with the cluster of dangling tassels that danced when I walked. I grabbed the Tupperware I had packed the night before, packed full of some kind of hideously Midwestern fruit pizza I had made. Pillsbury croissant dough, cream cheese, sliced fruit. I'm sure I got the recipe from one of my grandma's old Taste of Home magazines. And I put it carefully in the back seat of my 1996 Pontiac Grand Am. And I drove the 15 minutes to Amanda's house, past farmhouses and fields of still sleepy cows, and the forest clearing that was always full of wild turkeys, which felt particularly cruel on this day. I was like, hi, I'm going to eat your brother later. When I arrived, Amanda was waiting at the door. Now remember, I had on my nice sweater, my nice skirt, the eyeshadow. Amanda was wearing a pilgrim costume. She had a white bonnet holding back her hair, a white apron over her black dress. I handed her the fruit pizza. Thanks, she said. She led me inside. And when we turned the corner to her kitchen, there it was, a spread that could feed the starting lineup of the Green Bay Packers. Creme brulee French toast, baked with a crackly caramelized crust. Donut muffins, their tops like little mountains, dusted in snowy sugar. A Bavarian apple tort so big, I imagine it had burst from its springform pan, like a button flying off a pair of pants. Cheesy scrambled eggs, a fruit platter for show. All beautifully plated on her mom's nice servingware, taking up every inch of space on the kitchen counter. But no one was grabbing the muffins or slicing into the tort because no one else was there. The house was silent. Am I too early? I asked. Amanda burst out laughing. I had been punked. You won't get the joke. 15 years later, I don't even get the joke. But we were in high school in suburban Wisconsin, where the only things to do are play silly pranks on your friends and go to Walmart. So somehow the scenario was funny to us. So we giggled, loaded up our plates, and moved to her dining room, where the table was set for two. We ate, we laughed, we went back for seconds. A tradition was born. By the next year, Amanda was no longer a new friend. She was my best friend, and we had all the same friends. So when Thanksgiving rolled around, we invited them all to breakfast. Everyone dressed up nicely. Amanda wore her pilgrim outfit. Mrs. Wasileski made us the same spread. And we ate and belly laughed and ate before everyone scattered to be with their own families. But we were a family. We were a friend family. And we promised each other this would become an annual tradition, no matter where we ended up in our lives. The next Thanksgiving brought that moment I know we all remember, the first time coming home from college. It felt so good to be back in Wisconsin, surrounded by my best friends, and of course, food that hadn't come out of a microwave. I felt blissfully far away from this new life that had been thrust upon me, this campus full of new, unfamiliar people, this big, daunting city called Chicago. Gathered around Amanda's mom's speckled marble counter, we hugged, we ate, we shared roommate horror stories, we got seconds of the creme brulee French toast. Around her dining room table, it was home. And it was, for a long time. Throughout our college years, Thanksgiving breakfast was always a priority. I started dating a cute boy who lived in Philadelphia, and when he invited me there for Thanksgiving, I booked a flight for noon on Thanksgiving Day, and we rescheduled breakfast to 6 a.m. A group of college kids Gathering Before Dawn. We were in charge of our own cooking that year. Too early for Amanda's mom. So by cooking, I mean Chris brought the bagels, Tiffany brought the cereal. We all stood over the stove together, bleary-eyed in our pajamas, making scrambled eggs. But I did make my flight. The year we turned 21, the Baileys came out for the coffee, the champagne came out for mimosas, because back then we called $6 sparkling wine champagne. And we started to talk less about high school and more about new friends the others hadn't met. We heard about new boyfriends, new girlfriends, internships in New York, dreams of moving to Seattle. Mrs. Wasileski became Barb. But as much as things were changing, it all did still feel like home. We would, as we had promised as 17-year-olds, do this forever. We would bring our kids on whatever far, far off day that we had kids. Heck, our kids would bring their kids. Kyla was the first to go. Her boyfriend, now husband, was too stressed out to squeeze in breakfast before the drive to his family's house. Tiffany got a job that sent her to Hawaii every Thanksgiving to cover the Maui Invitational, an NCAA basketball tournament. Chris got married. He and his wife could still come to breakfast, but they had to leave early to tend to the turkey that they were making at home. Now, this isn't as sad as I'm making it sound. There were new faces every year. Amanda's boyfriend turned husband came, brought his little sister. There were new friends. There was always a full table and plenty of food. But things were different. And then it was me. Because, of course, as much as you promise, things won't change. They always do. For one, I will no longer make a fruit pizza ever. But the real point, home, where I grew up, is now away. And away, this big, daunting city of Chicago, is home. And this year, that cute boy from Philadelphia, who's now my partner and co-puppy parent, wanted to host Thanksgiving, our first big event in our first home together. His mom, my parents, the two of us cooking everything, his signature corn pudding, my roasted brown butter cauliflower, us realizing our weirdly tiny oven was too small to fit a turkey, but that's another story. It was a wonderful Thanksgiving, but something was missing. And it wasn't even till writing this that I realized, but I called Barb yesterday, and I asked for her recipe for creme brulee French toast. I hope to eat it in person next year at my second home in Wisconsin. But if I can't, I'll bake it myself, and I'll raise a glass of orange juice and cheap champagne to home, old and new.
We are on to our final reader of the night. She's a very talented fiction and nonfiction freelance writer and a Between Bites co-founder whose food and drink writing has appeared in the Sun-Times, Tasting Table, Plate, and Daily Candy. Her essays have been published in Lucky Peach, Fresh Yarn, Hair Trigger, and on Chicago Public Radio. She tells stories around town with Second Story and is currently working on a story collection. Between Bites regulars have heard her tell the hilarious tale of a particularly pushy bongo room customer who fought hard for that breakfast burrito and a ripe ESPN zone crush that quickly went rotten. Please join me in welcoming Molly Each. Malachi and I were having our first date night in what seemed like months, sitting across from each other at OSB, you know, that minimalist bar off Longman and Eagle. It was a warm summer night, and we were snacking on olives and cheese and sipping on our second round of old fashions when my phone dinged. I dug around in my purse like Pavlov's dog, my instincts trumping my earlier suggestion that we ignore our phones. Prince is playing City Winery tonight, my friend wrote. Thought you should know. I shrieked, startling the creatively facial-haired dudes next to us. Prince, my idol, my love, my fellow Minnesotan.
While rumors always surrounded the purple one, I knew he was in town for a private concert for George Lucas and Melody Hobson, so this made sense. A quick social media check saw rumors confirmed by several legit news sources. I could feel my eyes becoming wide with determination. We are going to that show. Malachi gave this little nod shrug. Sure, he said. But his blue eyes, framed by his red hair and freckles, narrowed. But you know it's probably not going to happen, right? I sighed. It was like he didn't even know me. We are getting in, I said, pounding the table for emphasis and taking down the rest of my whiskey cocktail. Malachi and I had just celebrated our second wedding anniversary, and for the most part, it had been pure bliss. It was like we walked through the world with Prince's Adore as our soundtrack. It was like every time he entered a room, I saw him in slow-mo and heard Dreamweaver playing like Wayne's World. But the last few weeks, something had been off. Blame unsustainable work hours, travel, and prioritizing everything over each other, but we'd both been kind of on edge. You guys know what I mean, right? If you've been in a relationship, that feeling that something's just off. When we spoke, it was like our words collided in the space between us, like two ESPN commentators talking over each other via satellite. The weirdness just simmered under the surface. But rather than turn toward each other and confront it, we had turned away from each other, burying ourselves in busyness that allowed us to maintain this pleasant exterior full of hugs and kisses and I love yous, all genuine and all true, but without ever digging into the muck beneath. This date night was supposed to be a start, when we'd spend some time together and figure out what was up, until we got the Prince news. We worked out a plan. Well, I worked out a plan, while Malachi nodded along patiently. Tickets were long gone. Prince was set to go on at 11, so we'd show up at 11:30, and some kind soul would somehow get us in. They just had to. With 2 hours to go until showtime, we ordered another round of drinks, and then another. Those Longman whiskey drinks are dangerously good, and I felt myself stumble as we got into the cab. We're going to see Prince, I slurred to Malachi, surprised at how it was suddenly so hard to enunciate. I saw him shake his head a little bit, or was that just my whiskey haze? And I turned away from him annoyed and looked out the window. I wasn't going to let him ruin this. We were going to see Prince. This was happening. Okay, time out. To understand my intensity, you have to understand Prince and Minnesota. See, in Minnesota, we don't have anyone. Bob Dylan kicked us to the curb once he left, and we occasionally have like a Kirby Puckett or Kevin Garnett kind of athlete, high profile and committed to us. But our hometown celebs are more understated. So much so that you probably don't know who they are. But Prince was ours. He bought records at Electric Fetus like us, went to concerts at First Ave like us, rode his bike around town, threw last-minute concerts on a whim just for us locals. We knew where he lived, and in high school, my friends and I would cruise around Paisley Park, certain we'd see him walking around and we could say hello. I left Minnesota at 18, and whenever I've traveled, from California to Madrid to Nepal, when I tell people I'm from Minnesota, I get one of two responses. Oh, it's really cold there, isn't it? Or, Prince! Prince is as synonymous with home as summers spent on any of our 15,291 lakes, or a table full of hot dishes, or winters spent on skates and sleds, no matter how many degrees below zero. He goes with all of it. And to those who grew up there, he is one of us. Our cab pulled onto West Randolph and stopped. Traffic was backed up, and I could feel myself panicking. Let us out here, I slurred, opening the door before our driver was fully stopped at Green Street. I got out of the cab and started speed stumbling down Randolph, a whiskey-fueled intensity pumping through my veins, pushing me forward with every drunk person I passed, every obstruction I dodged. Every step I took, the same sound rang out to me. Home. I needed it. I was desperate for it. I felt weirdly adrift in life at that time. I was feeling disconnected from my husband, working too hard at a job I didn't know I wanted, unsure about my place or my path, unsure about anything. At that moment, seeing Prince would be akin to pulling into my parents' driveway and seeing the porch light on. Being in the same room with him would be like seeing all the ingredients for palachinkas, my Hungarian mom's signature comfort food, laid out on the counter. Hearing his music would be like driving around the lakes I've known my whole life, wind rushing in through the window. All those signs that comfort you, that show you it will all be okay eventually, and that you have it in you to get out of this rut. And here he was in Chicago just when I needed him. I raced up to the outside bouncer, a round guy in a fedora. "Hi, I have to see Prince. I have to see this show," I said, holding my hands in this prayer position. He shrugged. "Sold out." Whatever, I didn't have time for this joker. I dove through the doors to the host stand, only slightly aware that Malachi was behind me. A trio of hosts stood shoulder to shoulder like three cartoon birds on a limb. Led Zeppelin played in the background, mixing with the clanging of silverware against plates from late-night diners and drinkers. "You guys have to help me. I have to see Prince tonight. I know it's sold out, but I just have to see him. Please, please, please." They glanced at each other and all shook their heads kindly. "But come on, there has to be some room. You can't just squeeze me in the back, please. I have to see him." One of the hosts stepped out from behind the desk in front of me, and I was in this weird prayer position again, leaning into him so he could feel my desperation. "I'm sorry," he said, putting his hand on my shoulder, delivering the news with the gravity of a doctor. "There's nothing we can do." But I'm from Minnesota." I pleaded this as though he would have turned to me and said, Wait, you're from Minnesota? Why didn't you say that before? Come on in. We have a special all-Minnesota VIP area. Oh, and then Prince is doing an additional late-night set only for Minnesotans. Welcome." I stood there for a minute or two. I hadn't planned on not getting in. I walked outside, leaned my shoulder against the brick, and started crying. I'm definitely not the only person to ever weep drunkenly on Randolph Street, but I couldn't help it. Disappointment rushed out of me as I cried into my hands. Home was right there on the other side of this wall, and I couldn't see it. Plus, I was wasted. Malachi stood next to me with his hand on my back, and I could feel the discomfort in his touch. We took a cab home, and once our front door closed behind us, the dam broke. We argued, and to this day, I can't remember why, only that it was about nothing and everything. Weeks of pretending things were okay, tumbling like a pop can building up force. The funny thing is, if we had just spoken up earlier and talked about it, it would have been easily squashed. "Hey, here's how I'm feeling." "Cool, here's how I'm feeling." "Great, well, let's do better." But not prioritizing our relationship, not reaching down and pulling each other out of the muck, and suddenly we were chasing Prince drunkenly around town and having a late-night wasted fight. That wasn't us. We were a better team than that. The next morning, I woke up with a screaming headache. My mouth was thick and gauzy, my gut full of embarrassment. I turned over to face Malachi. He was already awake. "Wow," I said. "That sucked." He chuckled. "Sure did." Tentatively, we wrapped our arms around each other, and I found that little nook in his neck that was made for me. As the sun streamed into our room, we talked about what's been going on, and I realized that what I had been looking for the night before was a rock, an anchor, something to grab onto when I felt lost, and here it was, right next to me. This was home. When I felt alone, I didn't have to run around town looking for a diminutive purple-clad performer. I had Malachi to steady myself. That's what this whole unconditional love thing is about, and one of the best parts of tethering yourself to someone forever. We got out of bed, put on a Prince record, and Malachi made me his special eggs for breakfast. It was awesome.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about us at between-bites.com and follow us on social media as Between Bites.